welcome to Higher Ed, KUT's podcast focusing on issues of higher education, lifelong learning, and exercising the brain. I'm Jennifer Staton with KUT 90.5, Austin's NPR station, talking as always with Dr. Ed Berger, president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
Well, I could tell you're blue.
Well, my shirt is blue,
yes.
But I'm okay.
Oh, okay, you're okay.
So I'm all right.
Oh, the only thing blue about you is your shirt.
And my eyes.
And your eyes.
And
oh,
my
look,
eyes.
You have, that's right. You have blue eyes. You do.
Mm-hmm. So I'm especially excited about this episode because I think this is something that's right up your alley.
Thank you.
This is from a listener. Rebecca wrote in, and I'm just going to read a little bit about what she wrote to kind of lay the foundation here.
Okay,
so,
go ahead.
Rebecca writes, my older brother is very smart. He can read something and understand it. Now, she says that she is a, what she puts in quotes, learn by failure type. Hmm. She says she needs to have a sounding board to compare ideas and to see what mistakes are and to learn from it. So she says in school, she didn't do well on quiz. She did well on quizzes, but then not on tests. And Rebecca goes on to say, now that I'm out of school, I'm trying to read and try to learn things, but without discussion. She says, I'm not retaining anything, and I fear that I am not really understanding concepts. So she wants to know, Ed, how you feel about, you know, doing classes over Skype or video for people who can't be in a classroom together in person. So, I mean, I think she's asking about, you know, with all the technology there, and you've certainly done a lot of this work and a lot of instruction, you know, via video, how that learning, if it's different than learning in the classroom, and if it is, are there ways to sort of mitigate that difference and help people who might need that in-person, you know, bouncing off ideas and that in-person reinforcement? What do you think about that intersection of technology and learning styles?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you've asked about 80 questions there.
All right. Well, let's get started.
All right. Well, first of all, it was interesting to hear Rebecca's story, and obviously, you know, I'm a huge fan of her categorization of learning by failure, because I think that is the most powerful way of learning. There's no greater teacher than one's own mistakes if we learn something from them and not let them go.
Right.
The other thing I want to just bring up from what she shared with you was this idea about the quizzes and the tests, you know? Mm-hmm. I find this very thought-provoking, and I'll keep this short because it's a little bit off topic, but she did mention this. We give students, and again, I'm thinking a little bit focused on math here, but it's true, I guess, across other disciplines. But we give students, you know, various homework assignments that they do, and then they do it kind of at their leisure, right? I mean, how do they do math homework, right? They're listening to their, you know, iPhones, they're online, they're tweeting, and then between, they're watching TV, Netflix, and then between that, they'll do a little bit of work, right? And then they'll figure it out and take a break. And so that's the bulk of their practice. And then when we do the big assessment, like the actual exams that count, they sit in a chair, not in their home or apartment or their room. They're given a test. They're given a time. And that, I mean, that's why we have math anxiety. It's a totally different experience. Where do we train individuals in terms of just the subject and mastery of the subject to be able to articulate their thinking in that style when throughout the rest of the time they're engaging with the material in a much more casual way? So what I do in my classroom, by the way, is I have where there's no cost, you know, so it's not like there's any penalty. I give these kind of quizzes and exercises in the classroom where I put lots of pressure on my students. I give them a question and say, you've got 20 seconds to answer it.
So it's practicing the style and scenario of a testing situation.
If we're going to test that way, then we've got to prepare them for that. And so I do a lot of that where I'm actually yelling at them, you've got, you know, 10 seconds left, hurry up, hurry up. And I try to, it's almost like one of these officers, you know, in boot camp, where I try to get them to ignore the stimulation around them, which is just noise, and to try to really focus in on their thinking and to not be distracted. Because people are distracted today, and it makes a difference. So, I mean, getting back to her point about the quizzes and the tests, I think that it's a really valid point that, you know, where do we teach people how to take those tests?
Well, and essentially what you're saying is that the style and the setting makes a difference in the performance.
Exactly.
And so you're helping students recreate that test situation in a practice way before they actually get to a test. So what about the other end of the process? What about at the learning end then? You know, Rebecca's saying that when she was in school, you know, she got reinforcement from being in the classroom with people, but you know, with technology now, is learning via that technology, is it, I'm sort of putting different in quotes, different mm-hmm. than the classroom experience?
Well, so it raises the meta question about the reality that formal education today is non-individualized. It's non-individualized. That is to say, we bring people together, they sit in the same space at the same time, they look at the same material, they have the same assignments, they're due at the same time, we give the same exams, they have the same everything. It is not at all designed for the learner. So if you and I were in a class together, it's not as if the curriculum and the way of learning and the way to get to that those learning goals would be different for Jennifer than it would be for Ed. But that's not how it works. We would do the same thing. So given the fact that we have a non-individualized style, which I think is bad, it raises the question. For some people, for example, like Rebecca, being part of a community of learners is important. Other people, like maybe her brother, doesn't need that community infrastructure to have the conversation. I don't think there's a right or the wrong thing. But the real underlying issue is, what are we defining as learning?
Exactly.
And what is mastery? Is it that I want you to know how to factor these polynomials and do this calculus, or do I want you to look at the world in a particular way? And to me, videos, and you know, I've got about 4,000 math videos out there in the world that, you know, folks, do you know that 45% of the nation's youth use my videos to learn math? And in Texas, it's 54%. But all those videos are focusing on the content. And while there is a kind of a nod to how to think mathematically, I do not have the opportunity to change those students' lives as I do in the live interdiscourse with another human being. And that's why, even though technology may come in and offer different rubrics, we talked about in a previous episode about, you know, whether the hour format's the right format or not. Even if you introduce technology for different rubrics, I think that the interaction with human beings, if it's instructor-student, and it could be through Skype, so it could be that you have a live kind of interaction, doesn't have to be in the same room, although I think that that works out better, it allows individuals to really exchange ideas rather than just have communication flowing one way or do artificial intelligence to kind of, you know, have a kind of a generic response. And I think that really is a reality. But how to get to that point of mastery and how we define mastery is the real question. I would define mastery not solely about content, but about how it's impacting how we look at the world, how we think effectively, and how we can actually use our own intellectual gifts in the most profound way.
Well, I was feeling not terribly intellectually gifted as I struggled with the puzzler
from the last episode. The crates of fruit puzzler,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
So let's go back to that. I think I got partway down the road to solving it. But
let me remind everyone what it is, and then we want to hear your thing. So you're in a fruit factory. You have three very large crates in front of you. You know that one crate contains only apples, one crate contains only oranges, and one crate contains both apples and oranges. The crates are labeled, and one is labeled apples, one is labeled oranges, and one is labeled apples and oranges. But you are told that the labeler just completely messed up, and in fact, every single label is wrong. Now, the question is, if you were to just reach into one of these crates, just feel one piece of fruit and pick it out and look at it, just looking at that, nothing else, can you now label all the crates correctly? That was the challenge. Now, what do you think?
Well, so the place I started was, let's say I reach my hand in and I pull out a piece of fruit. It's an orange.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I know that that crate can't be the apple crate.
Correct.
But it could be the orange and apple crate.
Right.
So I can get one crate taken care of label-wise, but not the other two because I don't know if it's apples and oranges or just oranges.
I like this thinking, but you've missed an opportunity.
I'm missing an opportunity.
Yes, because you're forgetting the fact you just picked a generic one of these crates and you did this.
Well, right. I picked, and I'm for my example to try to figure it out, I said, okay, I pulled an orange.
Right. But you can be strategic as to which crate you look at. Remember, they're all labeled.
But they're labeled wrong.
And you know that, but you can use that to your benefit. So which crate should you pick and do your experiment from?
Which one should I pick? Knowing it's labeled wrong,
mm-hmm.
apples and oranges.
Correct. Very good. And for the very reason that you gave. So when you pick out that one, okay?
I pick it out.
So you know that it's not the apples and oranges one.
Right, because it's labeled wrong.
Right. So if you see, for example, if you pull out and you see an orange, then you know that the thing that says apples, in fact, is going to actually be oranges.
Could it be that? Could that one be apples and oranges, though?
Well, if it's apples and oranges, then that then the third one is correctly labeled, and that's not right.
And they have to be all wrong.
Right, exactly. So the point is that when you pull out, and you, for example, if you see an apple, then you know that that it's all apples in there, because it's not going to be apples and oranges. So that's the apples one. The one that was labeled as apples must be oranges, and the one that was labeled as oranges must be both.
Got it.
You got to think about that a little bit. You got to kind of process that a little bit.
You do have to process that.
But you have to remember that all the labels are wrong. That's the
key.
And by pulling out one from the apples and oranges, you get a lot of information.
That's really interesting because I think I took your instructions very literally.
Uh-oh.
So I wasn't allowing myself to look at the crates.
No, I said you can't look at what's inside.
Right. I just was reaching in.
You were not
sort
being
of
literal.
Like I was drawing a number out of a fishbowl or something, and I didn't look at the
These
outside
were crates,
of the crate.
They were
either.
Not fishbowls,
right.
And they did not have
but
fish.
But I'm just sort of,
this was not a sushi factory.
No, but I'm just sharing out loud my process, and I'm realizing that I didn't, I gave myself a pretty narrow sort of path of how to actually
But
do
the thing
it.
I liked was that when you pulled one out, you started to make deductive reasoning, and you said, I couldn't get all the way. But if you pick a particular crate to look in, it gets you all the way there.
Mm-hmm. It does get you all the way
Neat.
There.
Well, congratulations. Well done.
Well, getting back to sort of our discussion about learning and technology, and people say apples and oranges. I'm wondering, as we kind of wrap up here, from someone who has taught in the classroom, has also taught extensively on video, are those the same teaching and learning experiences, or are they apples and oranges?
Well, I think it's both, which is, you know, that third crate. There are two things that we want to do. We do want to teach individuals about some of the most impactful ideas of human history, whether it's in the sciences or the humanities or the social sciences, the fine arts. And so the content is important, but it's not to eclipse the way of processing knowledge, the way to understand things more deeply. And I think through various technologies, we can actually amplify our abilities to share that knowledge and go deeper. But I think to harness the elements of creating a mindset, that really can be enforced dramatically by the live interdiscourse. I think at the end of the day, it's all about capturing people's imaginations. If people want to learn, then they will learn. And so if it's a video, then the video has to be entertaining or interesting or intriguing. And if it's a lecture, it has to be the same thing. A live, boring presentation is going to be bad, just as a videotaped, boring presentation. They have to be exciting. Learning has to be fun, dynamic, and we have to encourage people, capturing their imagination, to want to continue to learn, not just about the facts, but about how to process that fact.
Well, Ed, thank you for helping us keep our brains sharp and continuing to learn. Dr. Ed Berger is president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. You can find out more at southwestern.edu and keep your brain busy by keeping up with the news and other episodes of Higher Ed at KUT.org. You can also find us on iTunes. I'm Jennifer Staten with KUT News.